Access number 27202, Colonel James Dowson, Real 2. We're talking about your time in Sunderland during the war years. We've dealt with the air raid shelters. What about the blackout? How was your house blacked out and what effect did it have?
Well, blackout was very effective. We had a frame, which I think might have been made by my father, and because he was a great handyman. And he made, this frame had black material and then a baffle around the edge. And outside, and where I lived, was inky black during a blackout. It seemed to me to be very effective. And also, as I got older and ventured beyond my local area, I can remember Sunderland seemed to be blacked out very well. That might have been because it might have been not all that effective. And then when Sunderland started to get a pasting, people tightened up on the blackout. And so when you went out, there was the usual mantra, you know, got your torch, got your gas mask. And you'd go out with a torch and a gas mask, and by Jove, you needed a torch. It was terribly dark outside.
Was your family connected anyway with the air raid precaution units?
Yeah, my father used to do fire watching in the Royal Infirmary. But that's all. He was too young for the First World War and too old at the beginning. And actually right through to the end of the Second World War.
Did he see himself, I mean, you were too young probably to know, did he see himself as, some people would say that was lucky, other people would think he was dreadfully unlucky.
No, my father saw himself as very fortunate. He had no appetite for war. He was a patriot, all right, but he didn't fancy getting putting himself in danger. He really regarded, as most people do, I suppose, that war was bizarre and silly activity, and particularly if you reflect upon dying for your country. You know, there's no aftermath. You can't reap the reward of dying for your country.
And did he pass this attitude on to you then or later or?
No, I think I was a great one for surviving all these hazards, killing umpteen Germans and being decorated for bravery and gallantry and all the rest of it.
You took a more optimistic view than he did.
Yes, yes.
Now, what about the other effect of war often is rationing, sort of food and clothing. How did the food rationing affect the family?
Again, I have very little perception of any shortage. I can remember rationing, and I can remember seeing rations as looking quite small in quantity, but we always got them. And I think my father probably supplemented the rations because, being in the infirmary, they had special privileged extras, some of which were harvested by the staff, and he was no exception. He would bring home the odd things because there's... with everything, even with rations, there's an element of wastage, and rather than see the wastage go to the pigs, it came to us.
So it was a perk, but not
it was a perk,
black
yes.
market perk.
It was a perk. It wouldn't he didn't steal from the hospital, but he made better use of the waste than the use that was intended, or the destination was altered. It was waste just the same.
And did you notice the sweets? I mean, because you were just old enough at the start of the war to have liked sweets. I mean, did you miss them? Because they disappeared.
Not particularly. I suppose I didn't really have a great sort of longing for sweets. I just didn't share my colleagues' enthusiasm for sweets and things.
What about the disappearance of fruit or something?
Ah, yes. I remember noticing that, and we all rejoiced when bananas came back. That would be later on.
What about clothing rationing? Did that? Did you notice? I mean,
no. I'll just finish a little bit about food. Bananas came back, and this was treated with great rejoicing. And I ate a banana and had the most appalling diarrhea for 24 hours. Which was very memorable. My first banana.
So you just weren't used to it then.
That's right.
And what about clothes? I mean, did you notice?
My mother was a dressmaker. And so a lot of the clothes were made from materials, not necessarily new materials from a roll, but salvaged materials. And we actually came across things which caused great amusement to my family when my mother was going through all her old things, came across some amazingly bright yellow underwear, ladies' underwear, which was made, and there was some which was a sort of khaki beige colour, but there was this amazingly bright yellow underwear made from nylon, which was from parachute silk, as it was called. And anything that could be changed into clothing was, and we never went short of clothes. Shoes, I suppose, were made to last, so that my father had a cobbler's last and nails and segs and so on. Everything was mended. But it didn't seem that, you know, there was no sense of dissatisfaction. In fact, quite the opposite. Things that were mended, we felt rather proud of. So as far as clothes rationing and other things like that were concerned, as if you want to put us in a class, we were strong supporters of the system. It seemed reasonable and fair and economical.
Now, what about as the war came drifted to an end? I mean, any memories, or was the next thing the V-Day? I don't know whether you had street parties or anything.
We didn't have a street party, not in Hilton Street. I can remember lots of, to roll out the barrel type sessions, lots of people holding arms across each other's shoulders and dancing in the streets and things like that. But all pretty much my peers. I was 15 when the war ended and beginning to associate with peers rather than on my own rather than in my parents' shadow, as it were. And there was a great deal more. There seemed to be, I just have to remember that, there seemed to be a great deal more tolerated communal activity then than there is now. People tend to do things on their own now or in very small groups. We seem to go around in large groups and be very tolerant of each other. And so there was, yes, lots of singing in the streets. No formal parties that I remember.
And how did you feel about the end of the war yourself? That and VJ Day as well, but I mean...
I suppose it was I was beginning to feel that there was a great sense of relief, but I was beginning to feel... I've got to be careful here, because I don't know whether this is subsequent thoughts tinkering with memory. There was a no fraternization rule when they occupied Germany. And I can remember, I suppose, and there were people who were only a little bit older than me who'd actually been called up and were coming back on leave because it was the end of the war, and they were coming back on leave and they'd been in Germany. And I can remember they were offering a point of view that at first I was very unsympathetic with, and that is that the Germans were just normal people who were, you know, wanted to get on with their lives and were just as happy as we were. Peace was around. And I remember thinking, well, no, the Germans are wicked villains and they deserve all they get. And I remember that changing. So that I think by the time I was 18, I suppose, I changed my views altogether and realized that my personal feeling was that the more you got on with it, the more likely it was that you wouldn't fall out.
And that changed over that 3 years? Basically.
Just over the 3 years, and around about the average time, I suppose, for a teenager to change his views from being very much a sort of patriot to a sort of an undiscriminating patriot to one who started to think a bit about the implications.
Were you political at all? Because this was a time, I mean, the 1945 general election and the Labour Party.
Yeah, very much a socialist. And, you know, I don't know where the quote originates from, but it was given to me as coming from Ernst Reuter, who said that anyone who's not a socialist before the age of 35 has no heart, and anyone who is a socialist after the age of 35 has no brain.
So, were you actually a member of the Labour Party? Or
no,
or just a
no,
sympathizer?
Just a sympathiser. I thought it was great for everybody to be equal. Not realising, of course, that I was anything but equal.
Now, what that leads us on to, I mean, what about the question of your university? You know, because you've got call-up looming in when you're 18, but you've also got, at the same time, university looming.
Well, I very much wanted to go to university. I didn't want to... there's the paradox there. You see, I was a socialist, but I didn't want to be associated with the... Hoi polloi, as it were. I wanted to remain elite and, I suppose, in the end, become a champagne socialist. I call the people I admired. and it failed. I didn't work hard enough. And so, although I had plenty of intelligence, I didn't have enough repertoire to pass the scholarship exams.
Now, that's to where? To for university
Oxford.
Or just to Oxford and Cambridge?
Oxford
were
and Cambridge.
Were you particularly set on Oxford and Cambridge at the time?
Well, all the rest of my peers were, you see, and most of them got in. I think there were 90 applicants and 72 of them got to Oxford and Cambridge. So I felt really... It was almost the first rebuff of my life in the sense that I'd actually failed in something I wanted to do. I stayed on after higher school certificate to take these scholarship exams, and I got deferment to take them, and took them, and got very close in Oxford, but failed, I think, on repertoire. I'd done very well, but they offered me various questions in zoology and botany and so on, and I just didn't know, because it was outside my repertoire, and so I couldn't tell them because I had never encountered it, and that I faltered on that. I went to Cambridge and again got very close, at least I thought I got very close, and they wrote back and said, no, we won't have you, and I wrote back saying, have you perhaps made some mistake? And they wrote back and said, no, we haven't made a mistake at all. We don't want you. And Oxford said, try again after you've done your national service.
Now, did you then get your... Because you had a place at Leeds. Did you get your place at Leeds then or after your national service?
No, I went and did my national service, April 1949.
Now, tell me about the call-up. How was it arranged? You were called up basically from leaving school then?
Yes. I got a notice saying I had to report to Queen Elizabeth Barracks.
Now, how did you react to the call-up? And, and what was the actual process? Because you presumably had to register and get health checks and things.
Yes,
like
that. Registered, went through to Newcastle, got a medical in the old Eldon Square, some of the buildings in old Eldon Square, and was told that I would probably go into the RMC as a potential medical student, because I hadn't been accepted then, although I wanted to do medicine by then. And then if I failed to get into Oxford or Cambridge, I'd have to go and do my national service. Somehow or other, I had to either tell them or they discovered, or in some way they were informed that I had failed, and so I got a notice saying that after the deferment, I got a notice of deferment, because I must have applied for that, and then the deferment ran out, and they must have said, if you have not got acceptance, please let us know, and your deferment runs out. And then I got a notice to join. It was a sort of envelope with a warrant on it and things like that. And mother took me down to Sunderland Station, stepped on board the train, and arrived at Queen Elizabeth Barracks in Aldershot.
Now, what were you joining? What was the unit called?
It was the RMC, basic training.
Is this their depot?
The depot, yes. Queen Elizabeth Barracks was the depot. It used to be called Boyce Barracks. It was called Boyce Barracks, and then they changed the name to Queen Elizabeth Barracks because I think Queen Elizabeth,
the Queen Mother.
The Queen Mother then, which she wasn't then, but it was King George's wife.
Yes, so it was that.
Yeah. she was Colonel in Chief or something, and so they changed the name.
Now, I mean, joining the army is always a strange thing. So what happened when you arrived at Ulster? How do they sort of take you through the door and you go from being a civilian young lad to being the lowest of the low? Tell, you know, what did you do when you got to Aldershot?
When I got to Aldershot, we were treated very nicely. We were invited to get onto lorries, I think it must have been, and helped up with our kit and so on. I drew a certain amount of attention to myself because I had an American army tunic on. It fitted me very well and it was sort of smartly cut, and it had the sort of Norfolk style gaps in the back so that you could bring your arms forward and so on. And I think it still had some of the brass buttons on it. But
where had you got this from?
I just bought it in a Army and Navy store, surplus, Army surplus. Or rather, my mother bought it for me. And I wore it and really enjoyed wearing it because it fitted me very well. Like my father was at that time, a fairly broad-shouldered and so average utility clothing didn't fit me as well as this did. It was rather magnificent. I mean, very much superior quality to the sort of stuff that was around. And naturally, I just wore it, but I was the only one wearing that sort of thing, so it immediately drew attention to myself. It didn't worry me at all. Everybody was being nice to everybody else, and we all got in. We didn't have to march off or anything like that. We were ushered into a barrack room, and a nice young man came and said, "I'm a corporal in charge of you, and this is all your kit," and he showed us where we kept it and all that thing on the first day. Very nice, gentle introduction, and we all went to sleep in these beds in this barrack room that must have had about 30 people in, something like that. And at about 5:30 in the morning, this amazing creature, all dressed and sparkling and shining, shouting like mad at us, got us out of bed. And I'm fairly natural early riser. I got up and realized that things had changed. And he was chivying us along in the most peremptory terms. And got us all out onto the barrack square. And then we marched round the quartermaster stores and collected our kit.
Now, do you remember what kit they issued you?
Well, first of all, there was battle dress and boots and gaiters and webbing and blankets. We had blankets and so on. It was quite a long process. And I can remember when I was given this, we had a great coat, and most of the great coats were all the same colour. And except the one I was given, which was curious greenish colour. And I looked at this and said, "What an abominable shade of khaki." This caused a huge merriment among everybody. Which is why it sticks in my memory. I just made what I thought was a natural comment. It was quite different from all the others, and I retained it throughout my national service. I was rather proud of it in the end, because it, again, like the army, like the American army jacket, it singled me out from the rest. That's probably all I remember. I remember not feeling that I could possibly carry any more, with the blankets on one and a large kit bag on the other. Shoulder, staggering up the quartermaster stores with some distance from the primary barracks where we spent the first 2 weeks.
Did this stuff fit?
Fitted me, all right. Yes, it was okay.
What about haircut? I mean, because that can be quite a
yes,
shock.
We all went round and had a haircut. Again, it didn't worry me in the least. They just cut my hair and that was it.
Was it a tough haircut? I don't know
style
you had anyway then. You were probably short back and
no, it was all right. It didn't hurt or anything. It wasn't done in a brusque or haste. There was no haste about it. It was speedy, but wasn't...
But not shorter. Was it shorter than you were used to?
I suppose so, yes.
But you didn't care?
No, no. I was a great conformer in the sense that once I'd summed up the situation for myself, I realised that the way to deal with this was to fit in, to conform. And conform I did.
Now, we look at a sort of typical day, and there's no such thing really, but just something to hang their training on. If we start, though, with the barrack room, if you could describe what the barrack rooms were like.
So, a long room with beds down each side. I can't remember how many, but it would be about 30, I would think. 15 on each side, 10, 15 on each side.
And what kind of bed?
They were metal beds with legs that came out from the centre like that. And there was a little bed head at one end, and they were horizontal, sprung, you know, sort of net. And there was a mattress on them. The mattress we had was a single one, and it stayed down. We had a green, thin blanket, which had a line down the middle. And that was in lieu of a sheet, no sheets, and the blankets were a bit smelly. But this green thing was kept us from the the more filthy aspects of the blankets we were given.
And what about a locker?
Yes, we had a chest, a metal chest, and that went under the bed. And that was where the chap showed us where to keep everything, so that, you know, there would be people who had this heap of stuff, their own personal belongings plus one or two things they were issued with and so on, and had no idea how to get it into the chest. The chest was a uniform size, and we all bought a lock from the naffy to keep it locked. And the average chap would have no idea how to get all this stuff into a tiny box. So the corporal, when he was being nice to us, showed us how to put this all in. It was mainly personal belongings and a bit of space for the things that were subsequently issued with on the second day.
And any heating in there? It's April, but I don't know, sometimes it's hot, sometimes it's not. I mean,
don't remember being cold.
Now, what about this typical day then? What time would you get up for this basic
thing? 5:30.
And what was the more the first part of the day? I mean,
metal plates and a mug. Go and get your breakfast.
Now let's take. We'll deal with all the food together. Get it
all right
the
then.
Way.
Okay.
How was the food doled up to you? And food doled up to you. And what was it like?
I enjoyed the food, but I could eat anything. I still can. And it was substantial. It was the usual sort of breakfast. You know, bacon and eggs, that sort of thing. And thick chunks of bread, tea in a mug, which was always the same, thick, hot, sweet. And when you'd finished, there was two large hot containers, and the first one you rinsed your things in, and the second one you rinsed all the muck off, and the second one you rinsed them clean. They always felt a bit greasy at the end, but at least they were clean. Two metal plates and a mug.
And lunch or dinner, whichever you
can. Same thing, just line up.
What sort of food?
I always liked the food. It was always substantial, and it seemed to me to be tolerably cooked.
And what about the quality of the ingredients? Okay, from
every now and again, you'd have the odd hard potato and things like that with black bits in it. I just cut them out and chuck them away.
So nothing not too untoward.
No,
mass catering, anyway.
Mass catering, I thought it was all right. I used to enjoy the food. I'd even eat some of the food that people didn't want.
And was there enough?
Yes, always.
Mm. Now, after say breakfast, we'll move on from food. Mm. What sort of training sessions? We're looking at basic, really, at the moment.
Basic training, we'd have squad drill.
Tell me about drill. Had you ever done drill before?
Never.
Now, how did you...
Well, I was in the scouts, and so we'd sort of lined up in threes and things like that and stuck our hands out to do dressing. That was... but we'd never had the kind of standard of drill that was demanded of us in the basic training.
And now, how did you respond to drill and the repetition of it?
I mastered it in about, half a day. And then perfected it, you see. I got the idea in half a day, and realized that the only way to beat them was to join them, if you like. So I was all right. Never any problem whatsoever.
Did some of them have any trouble?
Oh yes, yes. There were some people who, well, first of all, they singled out the people, and it strikes me still as a bit odd that they hadn't done it before the pre-selection. Yeah, oh yes, sorry. There was a lot of selection went on in this first fortnight, so it wasn't pre-selection. This was the I think it was called the pre-selection fortnight, where they did all these intelligence tests and skills and so on. So we did a lot of that during the day.
I'll come back. Stick to drill for now. And I'll come back to
In the drill was the first thing, and because they had to get us into groups and then march us around all these selection boards and so on. So the drill, and in getting us into groups, they had to teach us some very basic drill, like standing at ease, attention, that sort of thing, and marching in directions.
And you were willing to conform, or
yes.
You decided?
So lots of them couldn't, and they got suitably criticised. No foul language. No foul language. And this corporal never, as far as I know, he would use the most utmost scorn, but never a foul word.
Okay, again, now, did you understand that you were willing to conform, no problem, but did you understand the point of drill at the time?
No, I didn't really give it a thought. I just thought to myself, this is a way of moving people around, but that didn't strike me as having any other military purpose.
Now,
if you had a group of, 18, 20 people, and you wanted to move them all around the barracks, you just made them into an orderly group and marched them around.
Now, what about this pre-selection process? Tell me about the sort of tests and things.
Well, there were intelligence tests, straightforward intelligence, IQ tests.
What type of thing?
Well, there would be mechanical aptitude, there would be comprehension tests of language and logic, and that sort of thing. I had to do them twice.
Why?
Because they didn't believe me the first time.
Because you did so well.
Yes. And what's more, some of the people who were manifestly sick had to do them twice as well, which rather upset me a bit. I thought, hey, what's going on?
So they checked the outer reaches?
Yes, they checked the outer ends.
You found no trouble with any of these tests?
None at all, no.
And what category did they put you in for?
They discussed whether or not I shouldn't go into the intelligence corps or something like that, or the education corps. It was very attractive because you were a sergeant, instant sergeant, if you went in the education corps. I started to reach out towards that, having worked out that I could do a lot better. But they said, if you're going to medical school, you may as well stay in the medical corps. So, once again, this was the year of my failures. Failed to get into university, failed to get into the better paid parts of national service.
What about the prospect of being an officer? Was that
I tried that twice and failed twice. No powers of leadership whatsoever.
How did they assess that? I mean, did you actually go to the...
Yes, I went to WASB, and the things they were looking for, I did very well in lots of them, but as far as leadership is concerned, I was and am hopeless.
What was the cause of that?
I think I argue too much, it's difficult to know, it's difficult to analyse it myself. I can't leave things alone, I suppose. I can't delegate very well. If I delegate something, I constantly interfere, and that impairs my qualities of leadership. Absolutely.
And that was picked up at the test.
Oh, picked up the test easily, yes.